Hello, this is Rachel Favin, and welcome to the Oncology Podcast, brought to you by oncologynews.com.au. Today, I'm discussing the Recapture Life trial with Ursula Sansom Daly as a follow-up to our very popular podcast from last year, Making Telehealth Human. Ursula, as some of you will know from her commentary pieces for us on oncologynews.com.au, is a clinical psychologist for the Sydney Youth Cancer Service. The Recapture Life trial is a recently published large randomized control trial examining the efficacy of a new online psychological support program for adolescents and young adult cancer survivors. As you're about to hear, the data revealed some very interesting implications for who online support works for best and when this support is best delivered. Of course, you'll find a link to the paper in the notes. Hi, Ursula. Welcome back to the Oncology Podcast. It's always such a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you so much for having me again.
So I'd like to start by asking you to summarize the study for listeners who might not have read the paper yet.
Yeah, for sure. So this is a study that's been going over the last number of years. It was actually originally funded through Cancer Australia and Beyond Blue Grant, which we were very fortunate to get. And this was led together with Professor Claire Wakefield and a number of absolutely amazing collaborators across Australia. Really, what we were trying to do was target this sort of tricky period for AYAs in that early post-treatment period, because a lot of our research was telling us that that time shortly after they finish, you know, curative, successful cancer treatment was still psychologically quite a tricky time for them as they were trying to get back into their normal routines, reintegrate with their normal communities. And it seemed to be a time where distress was sort of spiking again, even after treatment was done. So we developed this new intervention called Recapture Life, which was essentially designed to kind of equip young people with helpful coping strategies drawn from cognitive behavioral therapy, but also at the same time to link them in with peer support. So it was developed to be like a group-based online peer support group led by a psychologist where they would also learn coping skills. So funnily enough, we were, you know, doing the video conferencing thing before COVID came onto the scene. And so this study that we've written up here is really just the long-term results where we've evaluated that new Recapture Life intervention compared not just to a waitlist control, but also an active control. So we had a sort of a simpler, more non-directive online peer support group. So they'd still be getting 6 sessions together with peers, but just sort of chatting about life after cancer. So that's what we've reported on in this study here. And we had a final sample of 40 AYAs go through all of the assessment points, and they came from 10 hospitals across 5 Australian states.
Wow, great work. Thank you. So were you able to show improvements to the young people's quality of life?
So the short answer is no, unfortunately. So I suppose that was really what we were hoping to do at the outset. And I guess to go back a step, you know, when I was saying before that we were tackling this tricky period after cancer treatment was finished, the rationale was really one whereby, you know, we're aiming to teach young people helpful coping strategies to equip them with new ways to deal with the challenges of life after cancer. And you can sort of think about this as what's called as a secondary prevention or an indicated prevention approach. That's sort of language from the mental health world. But basically what that means is we think this is a vulnerable group. We're going to equip them with some skills or an intervention to hopefully prevent any kind of further distress from coming up. And so we did see that our Recapture Life participants, they actually did tell us that they were using more helpful coping strategies, CBT-based adaptive coping strategies after the intervention. So that was really positive. And that means that they felt more capable and that they were using more strategies to, for example, see things from a different perspective, you know, view a tricky situation from a different vantage point, or maybe actively seek out social support, or even to do things behaviorally to help calm themselves and deal with tricky emotions when they were feeling upset. So that was a really positive thing because that's what we're trying to help them to learn to do. But it didn't translate into improved quality of life after the intervention, in fact.
Yes, these are very important coping skills. I think we all need to practice them more, especially with all the challenges that COVID has brought to us. I'm interested to know how many of the young people attended the entire course.
Yeah, so we had 92% of our adolescents and young adults finish the 6-session course. And so, you know, one of the things that I'm sure we'll get to later is, although our opt-ins, you know, the initial kind of intake of people who chose to do the course was lower than expected. And that was interesting in and of itself. But the ones who were interested, once they were in, they really did complete the course at quite a good rate and, you know, reported that they got a lot out of it qualitatively and it was quite beneficial. I think that's kind of interesting because we know from other kinds of online interventions, like the sort of self-guided online modules and things like those can often have quite a steep drop off after the first one or two modules that people kind of will dip in and take a look and then kind of not really follow through and complete it. So I think that kind of showed us, and I suppose from the facilitator perspectives, running the sessions, we could tell that, you know, the peer support and that connection and normalizing experience that they got from connecting with other AYAs definitely was a hook that kept them very much engaged throughout.
Okay, so for the participants who did engage fully with the program, did you see any quality of life improvements with them or negative impacts perhaps in terms of their ongoing healthcare?
Yeah. So, I mean, picking up on your point before, so looking pre to post, unfortunately, we didn't see any improvements in quality of life. And actually, interestingly, we tracked participants up to 12 months later, which was an important thing to do because a lot of the time, a lot of the existing studies in psycho-oncology have sort of tended to do pre-post designs, and there hasn't been much in terms of the long-term follow-up. And tracking our participants 12 months later, interestingly, our Recapture Life group actually reported that they were perceiving more negative impacts of their cancer and actually more anxiety and depression symptoms 12 months later. So that was an unexpected finding for us.
Do you think it was because the participants were better able to identify and discuss the negative impacts of their cancer on their mental health?
It could be. And certainly that's one of the things that we've considered in our paper, is this idea that learning about how you cope and about the emotional impact of cancer and different ways of coping with that can certainly shift your perceptions of how you're dealing with that. And it could also be, as you kind of hinted there, that our Recapture Life group was also perhaps genuinely noticing, you know, changes in their health or impacts on their life. So one of the interesting things that we did see also with our Recapture Life group compared to the peer support or the active control was that 12 months later, our Recapture Life group was sort of seeing their general practitioners more frequently. They were reporting accessing their general practitioners more, and they'd also had more emergency department visits at the hospital. So it could actually be that there was genuinely more going on from them from a medical perspective. With, you know, the numbers that we had, it's a bit hard to say that for certain, or it could also be their perceptions of it was changing. One of the things, you know, that I think was interesting about this study, given that it was in the context of a sort of a survivorship intervention, you know, where we were recruiting young people who'd finished, you know, successfully finished curative intent cancer treatment, was actually we had 9 AYAs, or about 30% of our sample, experience cancer relapses from the point of study intake onwards. And sadly, we actually had 5 of our overall sample die at some point from the time they started the study. And so that was quite surprising and quite sobering. And I think for me, that sort of demonstrates that even after curative treatment and survivorship, many AYAs do continue to face ongoing and quite realistic medical challenges. And so I guess there's, in that early survivorship phase, there's always that difference between kind of achieving short-term remission versus what the longer-term prognostic outlook is.
Yes, so the challenge is ongoing for many of the patients who are in the survivorship cohort. Very interesting and, yes, sobering. Next, I'd like to talk to you about the data itself. There are some interesting implications from this. It's one of those studies, I think, where you've asked a couple of questions and the result is a lot more questions, which is why it's so interesting to discuss it in detail. Now, in terms of young people and their attitudes to online support, I think it's very easy to assume that young people want to do everything online, but that isn't the case, is it?
Yeah, so true. And I think this is a theme that we started talking about on our last telehealth podcast, because people do make that assumption about young people. And certainly even before COVID, there was that stereotype. But I think at a really broad level, it's useful to reflect on the fact that our opt-in rates were lower than expected, which I think potentially highlights that online supports and also potentially peer support group type models are not what everyone wants uniformly. So I think that's really interesting. And I think, you know, that'll, you know, we'll take more from that beyond COVID to sort of try and fine tune who's going to benefit the most from the online supports and who sort of may not. But, you know, I guess the other thing with our intervention is that we were, as I mentioned before, we were trying to sort of target a sort of slightly vulnerable group and equip them with coping skills through this online method. And one of the things that we noticed was that everyone who opted in basically on average was in the very normal range of depression and anxiety in the end. So in the end, the group that we reached, well, obviously whoever was keen on online support and, you know, was more drawn to that method, and also people who were kind of generally already fairly high functioning, I'd say.
So that neatly wraps up the who. Let's talk about the when. So did the timing of the intervention have an effect?
Yeah. So one of the things that I was keen to sort of try and understand is, you know, looking at our data, were there some groups that seemed to benefit more or less from these different online models of intervention? So the Recapture Life model, where we were sort of teaching some coping strategies, versus the kind of online peer support group. And what we kind of found when we drilled down on the data was that it seemed to depend a little bit on how recently you'd finished cancer treatment. And so AYAs who'd finished treatment more recently seemed to benefit the most from the simpler, non-directive peer support group. So it was still led by a psychologist, but they took much more of a back seat, and it was more just about the young people connecting and chatting about life after cancer. But on the other hand, the AYAs who are a little further post-treatment, so a bit more towards the, you know, 18-month, 24-month post-treatment, they seem to get more benefits from learning the adaptive CBT coping skills that, you know, that we taught in Recapture Life. So there's probably a couple of things that could potentially mean. It might mean that peer support is, you know, maybe the most powerful in the immediate aftermath of treatment after they're grappling with the experience. And it might also mean that it takes time for many young people to have maybe the emotional capacity, the mental capacity, the headspace to actually engage with coping strategies. Because often when we're learning new coping strategies, that's sort of asking you to think about things differently and feel ready to try and approach situations and problems a little differently.
Yes, that's so interesting. So the value patients derive from programs like this, very much dependent on their stage of treatment and perhaps the type of program or intervention that they receive.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I think, as you said before, our study kind of, our findings bring with them a lot more questions. And so I think, you know, one of the questions that we sort of pose in our discussion of our results is really, how do we design and target our supports best to the people who need them at the point they need them in a way that they're actually going to take them up? Because I think one of the things that's really tricky, and we've observed this and other groups around the world have observed this, is often when people say they need the support the most, you know, their point of crisis is not necessarily when they're actually going to be willing and able to take up those supports. So, you know, we've run a number of interventions now, including Recapture Life, where we would often, you know, maybe have a young person or a parent or someone like that 18 months after treatment say, oh, this would have been brilliant at diagnosis, or this would have been brilliant last year, and things like that. But, you know, then we also had a lot of people who declined to opt into the study because they just couldn't quite manage to kind of take that on board earlier on after treatment was finished. So I think really trying to understand how to target interventions in a way that, you know, that's going to be, I suppose, doable for people to take on at the right times is really important.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that the benefit of hindsight, it's easy sometimes to look back and think, oh, if I'd have done this then, it would have really helped me. But at the time, during active treatment, as you say, there's just only so much headspace, and notwithstanding all the practical implications, regularly committing to peer-to-peer support groups when you're in and out of hospital and going through active treatment. So yes, it seems like programs do need to be tailored to the different stages of survivorship and perhaps different patient cohorts. I'm thinking about patients who perhaps are less high functioning.
Yeah, and you're quite right there. And you know, I think it's an interesting one because when we set out to design this intervention and also the study, I mean, we were aiming for the most rigorous study methodology and the most, you know, gold standard evidence-based intervention design, you know, have enough of the evidence-based coping strategies and content and have enough of the dose and things like that. But what that resulted in was an intervention which on its face is quite intensive. 6 weekly sessions. The sessions were each about 90 minutes long. So 6 sessions plus a booster session, plus they're also doing lots of questionnaires as part of the randomized controlled trial. So it was quite intensive. And so in my mind, you know, I've sort of reflected that probably that does mean that you end up sort of selecting even beyond whatever your inclusion criteria, you're then selecting even more, again, perhaps for the young people who might already be a bit more high functioning, a bit more organized to kind of get things together to be able to commit to the 6 sessions and do the questionnaires and everything. So, you know, I think there's definitely scope to be thinking about our intervention designs and also our study designs, you know, how we're evaluating these interventions at different points across the cancer trajectory so that we are actually making sure it's quite inclusive for diverse groups.
Yes, lots of food for thought. What else did you learn?
Well, I mean, I think our findings coming out now has been nice in the sense that we are in this sort of flux of just telehealth and video conferencing post-COVID. And I think our findings highlight this theme that we began talking about last time, which is this idea that almost the myth busting that young people all want online support. And, you know, I think our lower than expected opt-in rates kind of potentially highlight that it's not necessarily everyone's bag, everyone's first preference. You know, one of the encouraging things was, though, that our sample was pretty much 50-50 young men and young women. So I think that's interesting in the world of psychology interventions because often it is very much skewed to females who will actually reach out and take up the support. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
So a lot of learnings for online support, but I think certainly highlighting that it's not necessarily for everyone. And I think tying in with that, we were kind of curious and interested that our opt-in rates weren't higher, particularly because there was so much research at the time telling us how hungry AYAs were for peer support, peer connections. And, you know, I've got a clinical role working with AYAs as well. And even when they're treated at a youth cancer service, they don't necessarily always meet that many people their age, you know, at the same time of cancer treatment as them. So, you know, there was that sense that peer support would be the thing to meet this big need. But I think, you know, there's increasingly more research kind of telling us that it's a bit more nuanced than that. So Professor Susan Sawyer and some of her colleagues down in Melbourne have certainly, you know, done some work highlighting this, that, you know, it might actually fluctuate over time, the extent to which AYAs want to be connected with other AYAs with cancer. And so it might be that during treatment, immediately after treatment, that's sort of more important, you know, that normalizing effect. But then, you know, maybe later on what they're wanting more is actually to reintegrate better with their home communities and their normal kind of pre-cancer or kind of non-cancer friends. So that was actually a focus of Recapture Life because that's all of the coping strategies were aimed to kind of help them make that transition successfully. But I think the fact that it was getting them together with other AYAs who'd had cancer, for some of them, maybe that was keeping them too much in the cancer headspace still.
In terms of coping skills in general, because that was really one of the very, you know, primary focal points of your study, do they actually prevent mental health issues?
This is such a big question. And I think this is a really good example of where our study has probably asked more questions that future researchers need to solve. So, you know, I'm a clinical psychologist, and so I fundamentally believe that there's value and benefit in teaching young people, you know, helpful coping strategies. I see it on a day-to-day basis. And certainly we know from all of our qualitative data that and the coping skills data that they did, you know, gain in that domain, and it was of benefit. But, you know, I think there's a bigger question there of this idea of prevention. So, you know, I'll preface this by saying, like, as I mentioned before, our group wasn't a clinically distressed population. So on average, they were not overly distressed. Their depression anxiety scores were all in the normal range. And so that's important to kind of know. And what that means is that we were sort of trying to do the secondary prevention model. So targeting a sort of slightly distressed at-risk population and helping them with coping strategies. And probably given the sample that we ended up with, we probably ended up with a more well-functioning population. So probably what we ended up doing was more that kind of universal prevention model. So I think our findings kind of tap into where the conversation is going now with prevention, which is that it's a bit more complicated. And I think that there's more recent and sort of emerging research now that's kind of showing a bit more mixed results for the more universal prevention model in mental health. So, you know, that might be an example of that might be going into schools and, you know, teaching just a very broad group of teenagers coping skills. And so, you know, increasingly, I think the conversation's turning more towards what kinds of social, socio-demographic or community-based factors might be good for the mental health of an entire group. And I think the other, you know, important point that often gets made here is that the absence of distress doesn't necessarily equate to good mental health and to kind of thriving and, you know, well-being and all those sorts of things. And so for AYAs, looking at those kind of aspects, it might mean more kind of focusing on things like, you know, how they're engaging or re-engaging with study or work or social supports in their community. So there's kinds of bigger picture social factors. So, you know, back to your question, I think coping skills remain really important. But for me, thinking about these AYAs over, you know, a couple of years into survivorship with all of the stuff that they had going on and potentially all of the medical challenges and the ongoing maybe cancer scares or things like that, it was important, but I think not the only important thing.
Yes, it's very nuanced. So this study is quite possibly the largest RCT of a psychological intervention for AYA cancer survivors in Australia, and certainly one of the most rigorous in the world to date. So what other observations can be drawn from the study?
Yeah, I think that one of them is just echoing this idea that has existed for a while, which is that survivorship is really a dynamic, nuanced kind of period. And you know, we say survivorship as though it means the same thing for all people, but we know that it can be so, people's experience of survivorship can be so various and different. And, you know, as we were saying before, we were surprised how many sort of relapses we had in our relatively small sample, you know, drawn from a population who were selected that they'd successfully finished cancer treatment with curative intent. And I think, you know, that does have important implications for how we design and develop supportive interventions into that survivorship period. And, you know, what I'm observing in the cancer center as medicine changes and evolves, so precision medicine is having more of a role. There are more and more kind of phase one trials and experimental therapies. That kind of gray zone where AYAs might sort of achieve remission in the short term, or their cancer might be kind of managed and held at bay in the short term, but they might also have a bit more of a guarded or uncertain longer term prognosis. I think that gray zone is going to expand a little bit. And so that does have implications for how we provide support to manage distress or concerns that young people might have around that.
Yes, it's interesting. I think there are, as you say, with the advances in the medicine, in the treatment, the technology, personalized medicine, genomic profiling, you know, there's always so much to be quite excited about, I think, in AYA and pediatric cancer treatment in general. But how that impacts on a patient's ongoing journey, and that those distress levels, where, as you say, survivorship is, you know, it's not just a single graph that sort of went up and now it's just going along down, la, 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 la. We're very much seeing ups and downs in that gray zone. So really highlighting the need for support in one way or another, rather, you know, it doesn't always have to be online. But what I'm trying to get around to is that for you in your role in supporting these patients whilst the medicine is, the advances are so incredible, it doesn't necessarily translate to less people that you need to help. In fact, more people, perhaps.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I think with that kind of dynamic and fluctuating outlook in survivorship, that does make it harder to know when's the right time to offer that support. And I guess the more work I do in this area, the less I'm convinced that there's any one time point where we could sort of say, oh, everyone should get offered support at this point. It just seems to me that everyone's experiences are so different.
Yes. So the picture becomes messier, I guess. But to bring back to the data, I think, yes, the relapses in particular are very sobering. And in terms of the study design itself, did you learn anything here?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was sort of mentioning before that I do think we need to think carefully about the study methods that we use and how they can sort of almost create these extra conditions on the patients or the participants who choose to participate. And that's always a challenge and a trade-off when we're working with vulnerable clinical populations. You know, on the one hand, we want to do the most rigorous research, you know, using the best gold standard scientific methods. But on the other hand, as I've mentioned, our intervention was quite intensive and the research design was also, you know, had intensive elements. So the randomization, the on sort of long-term follow-up, the number of questionnaires, all that sort of thing. And so that probably did kind of exert these additional effects on which participants took part and above and beyond actual inclusion criteria. So I do, you know, wonder if we maybe ended up with a much more, you know, high functioning, organized group who were actually able to commit, less chaotic, all that kind of thing. So that's, you know, something for us to think about when we're trying to do research that really speaks to the real world, is how mm-hmm. our designs have an impact.
Yes, it's always come back to that practical application that's so important. And conducting such a large study in itself must have been quite challenging.
Yeah, it was. And I feel so naive when I kind of look back at what our protocol and the timelines of what, you know, how quickly you think you'll achieve these things. But yeah, look, one of the key learnings was really the challenges involved in running the study itself. And not to be too negative, because obviously we were so honored to collaborate with wonderful people, researchers and clinicians from across the country. And the beauty of our intervention was actually its online nature. So that meant that we could recruit AYAs across the country, coast to coast. And I remember vividly running a group one time where I had participants from New South Wales and WA and South Australia all at the same time. And that was awesome. But the logistical aspects of actually having all of those sites on board, for example, at a very boring level, you know, meant having to get ethics approvals for all of those different sites. And so we noted in our paper that it took an average of 16 weeks to get ethical approval, but the range was up to 39 weeks. And so I believe our trial was originally supposed to just take 2 years. And so within that time period, that really does have an impact then on how many participants you can ultimately approach and recruit.
We're talking about nearly 9 months for ethics committee approvals. That's challenging.
Yes.
And inevitably, we've touched on it a little bit, but let's address the global pandemic. What are the COVID-19 implications?
So I think we've touched on some of it already, which is that our study findings do echo much of what we've been learning through COVID, which is that telehealth is really useful. It can solve this problem of geographic distance. It can solve a problem of access to specialist care. In this setting, it can connect AYAs to peers across the country, across all these different states. And that's fantastic. And, you know, I mentioned already that we had a nice sort of fairly equal split between males and females. So it's potentially a modality that's kind of maybe a bit more appealing to kind of both. And it's also the case that it's not for everyone. So as we saw with our opt-in rates, it's likely that online solutions are not everyone's first preference. So it remains that it's a really important adjunct. It's a really important kind of option in the menu of, you know, or the suite of kind of options that you might have. But when COVID restrictions permit, there's still immense value in that face-to-face option.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think particularly as a tool, as you say, to reach young men who perhaps are less inclined. Yeah, it certainly can't hurt, can it, to have as many options as you possibly can to reach people. So in terms of telehealth in general, how has this informed you? How will this affect your research work going forward?
Yeah, and I think what we have been able to demonstrate is that it's certainly very acceptable and feasible and safe. And, you know, across both of the online interventions, the kind of non-directive peer support group and the Recapture Life one where we're teaching coping strategies, they both had really positive therapeutic alliance ratings by the young people. So they perceived they had a good connection and rapport with the facilitator of the group. And they also rated really positively the group culture or the group cohesion in that online group. So I think that's been important data, you know, to just support the development of those kinds of programs online. And certainly we were able to show that you can manage distress quite safely and well, even when you're only interacting with these people through an online intervention. And we kind of documented some of our clinical management processes for, you know, how we would respond if a participant turned up and they were very clearly much more distressed that session than they had been the previous session, and how you kind of manage that in the online realm. And I think, you know, so it's laid a really good foundation for the acceptability and the place of these interventions moving forward. And next steps, my team's currently doing some work to kind of break open the black box of telehealth even more, so to speak. We're sort of looking at coding some of the interpersonal processes that happen between group members and facilitators to look at a bit more granular level, like what interpersonal behaviors online are most effective in promoting that emotionally safe, supportive therapeutic environment. And that will be helpful for sort of training and further implementation of online programs like this.
Lots more work to do then.
Yeah, more questions always.
Yeah, always. Do you have a key take-home message for our listeners?
Yeah, it's tricky, but I would say, you know, the take-home message is that these sorts of programs can fill a really important role for some young people and some young survivors. And I don't think they're a one-size-fits-all for anyone, but I don't know that we have many interventions that are, to be honest. So I think it's a really good option for many young people. And I think one of the things, going back to what this means for clinical practice, we've since been working with a number of fantastic community organisations like Canteen and Council of New South Wales to look at how an adapted version of Recapture Life could be delivered in community settings. And that work's going to be really important because even getting evidence for kind of manualised or evidence-based interventions, you can't do much with that if you don't have the workforce available to put them into practice. And I know there's a limited supply of psychologists in cancer centres and oncology settings. And, you know, the mental health workforce is always really stretched. And so we've been looking at that kind of partnership model as well. So where we train up the community organisations so that they can be able to deliver an adapted version to their members and young people. And that's another way of expanding those routes of access and to scale up who gets to access these kinds of supports.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point to wrap up on, actually, is that in an ideal world, of course, we would love every single young person facing these extraordinary challenges to be able to sit down with a psychologist every week and have that really in-depth support. But that's not possible for young people living in rural WA or all the other challenges that Australians uniquely kind of have to deal with during cancer treatment. So the more tools that you have and the more organizations that are able to support that, the better. So I always wrap up by asking if there's anything you would like to mention to help listeners who would like to learn more, if there are any resources in particular that you think will be useful.
Yeah. The results paper that all of this comes from is open access, which I'm really thrilled about. So that will be well available for everyone. And anyone who's interested generally is welcome to contact me to discuss further. You know, this has stimulated millions more questions for me. So always open to new ideas from others about ways to look further at this. And yeah, we're just going to continue our work in this space. One of the next things we're going to be doing is looking at really whether there's a need for diagnosis specific support. So one of the things that, you know, you could say about the Recapture Life group is it was what you could say is transdiagnostic, so mixed cancer diagnoses. And that seemed to be quite acceptable and that seemed to work. But, you know, we also know that there are particular cancers that have very particular needs. Brain cancer is a good example of that. And so I've got a fantastic PhD student and a team who are going to be looking at that question now. So AYA survivors of brain cancer, and do they have unique needs? And do we need to tailor a specific version of this for them?
Fascinating work. Well, please do keep us posted. We love having a chat with you and finding out what's going on. So thank you very much for your time. It's been a really valuable discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Oncology Podcast. If you enjoyed today's edition and would like to subscribe, head over to our website, oncologynews.com.au, and sign up to our newsletter. Thanks for listening.